Welcome to Cabronas y Chingonas, a podcast where we talk about queer and Latinx topics such as
Jada and Queen and Set It Off.
Oh my God.
Do you guys remember that?
I do. I think because they were, in my opinion, the best friends and they were always getting into it. There was this tension back and forth between them that I felt like they could have just taken the girlfriend out of the equation and made it about Latifah and Jada.
Yo, 1994. What were you scared of? Why wasn't Jada and Queen queer? That's the movie we really want to see. Shout out Widows, but like, come on, give us Set It Off with Queen and Jada being queer.
Right? I do have a slight story to share, which was in the 90s. I was new to LA. I went to a club here in LA, a queer club, and I was dancing, get my groove on. And I turn around and Latifah is dancing next to me.
No.
Oh my God.
With some girl. And I was like, I didn't know what to do. Like, there was no social media at the time, but I would have been like texting or tweeting or something.
You won't
about
believe.
It.
Oh my God.
You would never believe it.
I would have stopped dancing and like been like, I don't know what to do now. I'm just freaked out.
And that was the first time I saw her. And then I saw her other times rolling up in her nice motorcycle.
Oh my God, a motorcycle.
Which goals,
yeah,
man.
But she never, like in public, I feel like she never hit it in those circles. It was what it was. And then in her public persona, she was, you know, she made choices, so.
What up, cabrona?
What's poppin', chingona?
Nothing much. Just sitting here with one of our idols, if we're being honest.
I mean, low-key, right?
High-key. Yeah.
They ain't nothing low-key about this. I'm just acting low-key because I don't fangirl. So.
If our listeners have ever listened to our very first episode, Frederica covered a movie called Mosquita y Mari, which is a beautiful movie created by Aurora Guerrero, who is with us today.
She's sitting across from me, right beside Maite.
How are you doing today, Aurora?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much. Blushing over here.
Oh, gosh.
I think you were, like, the first movie I gave 5 panduces to. Like, and that's, like, a perfect rating for me.
Yeah, that's her.
I was going to ask about the ratings. Like, what is, so it's 5 panduces is, like, the ultimate rating.
Yes. Yeah.
And for me, it's cafecito. Zero so, cafecitos. Like, if you need coffee to get through it or not.
Yeah,
I can't remember my rating, but I'm sure it was like nothing.
Fun fact, I actually took the panduce thing straight out from your movie Mosquita and Mari, because you know what scene I'm talking about. She's like, it either smells like panduce, sometimes it smells like panduce, sometimes it smells like ass. And I was like, are we talking about panduce in a movie right now? And I was like, that's what I'm doing now. That's my rating system.
It was a joke. We came up with it on the spot in the first episode.
Yeah, it was on the spot.
And I was like, I'm going to rate it by café because I was really obsessed with coffee.
And
still
I was
am.
I felt so seen and represented by pan dulce in a movie. So I was like, pan dulce.
And so y'all have kept that rating system,
we
right?
We did, yeah.
Nice.
Apparently we make people hungry whenever we talk about it.
Yeah, like go get your empanadas and your conchas and, you know, shout out if your abuela makes it, though.
Makes conchas?
That would be amazing.
And empanadas from like the ovens like outside.
All right. So well, Aurora, we'd love to hear more about you, or like let our listeners know a little bit about you, where you came from, your upbringing, etc.
Yeah. So I am born and raised the San Francisco Bay Area, where my parents migrated from Mexico separately, but met in the Mission District, fell in love. And me and my brothers were born there. Shout out to the Mission and all my Mission homies. And then we made our way to the East Bay, where my parents opened up a small Mexican restaurant called Guerreros.
Wow.
Opened 20 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, jeez. 20 years. And it was our saving grace in many ways, because my parents were struggling economically, and we were actually looking at moving to Mexico. And my dad had been working in the service industry, and they rolled the dice and said, maybe we need to do something ourselves, picked Berkeley. And 20 years later, man, you know, it had sustained us throughout, including when I was in college. I went to UC Berkeley. So I'm a bear, golden bear. Chicana. Spent a lot of time going to Mexico. I had that privilege of being able to cross back over and got to know both my mom and dad's pueblos. My mom's from Veracruz, Jalapa. Shout out there. Hey. And my dad is from Ayutla, Jalisco. Shout out to all my primos and primas out there. I grew up super entrenched in my cultura. Grew up like bilingual, bicultural. My parents were very, very proud Mexicanos, Mexicanas. And I'm really grateful for the way they raised me.
How is the place and the community and your identity affected who you are now?
When you're saying place, you mean like where I grew up?
The mission. Your community.
Yeah. Because my community is, I always say that my community is the Bay, because I had so many identity shaping experiences in Berkeley, in Richmond, which is where my parents had a house, and in the mission. It was really beautiful to see, particularly in the mission, how like my folks were a part of an immigrant community that really was able to bring so much of their cultura to the U.S. and to maintain it and honor it. And for me to see that and grow up in that, I think it made me feel like I was incredibly proud of who I was, and very clear about where I was coming from. And so I didn't grow up like how you see in some films with that shame, mm-hmm. having immigrant parents. I didn't grow up in that at all. I grew up in this incredible sense of pride. So I never wavered or doubted or self-hated in that way. I had other issues with sexuality happening, but
that's real.
Definitely not with my ethnicity, my cultura. And, when I went to Cal, I started to connect more with my indigenous roots, which wasn't something that we always talked about in my home. Even though folks, we had the brown skin and we looked indigenous, it was just something that wasn't really talked about. And so that was another big part of who I became once I went through Cal. So comunidad, I'm here. I am sitting with this Raider hat in LA, walking around with a lot of pride. So it's played a big role.
That's
in my
beautiful.
Life.
Yeah,
that's amazing. Mm-hmm. Did you get to witness or have to witness a lot of like the gentrification that's kind of what gone on in the Bay Area?
That is real. I left in the early 90s when it was really starting to show its face. And the first place I started to see it was in the mission. I was living in the area. I had returned after I graduated from Cal. I went back to San Francisco and lived in the mission. And all of a sudden, we started to notice a lot more white people in the neighborhood walking around. Like, they live there, and we're like,
when they start jogging,
do they live here? Yeah. Jogging, bumping folks on the street, coming out of these new cafes. And the very, very first film that I ever worked on was a short film that I did with Veronica Vero Mojano, who is a filmmaker, artist, queer, Centroamericana from the mission, born and raised, and has not moved, I don't believe, from the mission.
She might
be one of the few. Yeah, she's done some incredible art. And another woman, Valeria Wilson, who didn't go on to do art, but the two of them and myself did this short called Jota Homegirl. It was about these three homegirls from the mission who had their own little issues happening in their personal lives, But one of the things that we were touching on was gentrification. And we didn't have the words for it yet, but we definitely felt the rage. Like, we were definitely feeling that anger. And so we started to, like, dive into that subject. And then I went on to film school, so I didn't really get to see how it manifested, but we were feeling that intrusion back in the, it was like 1992. And then I would spend, you know, months in LA, and then I'd come home and I'd end up in the Mission, and things were just hyper changed. And that rage that I was feeling then was just growing inside me. It was really, really hard to see and to hear the stories of friends who were no longer living in the Mission, that they had been pushed out because of gentrification. They couldn't afford it. You know, it's hard. It's a hard thing to witness. And you know, my heart goes out to the folks that have been in the Mission fighting to retain their housing, to stay in the neighborhood, to keep it grounded in what it's been for many years, which is a Latinx immigrant community. So there's a big fight out there, as there is here in LA as well.
Yeah. Everywhere.
Everywhere.
Oak Cliff,
yeah, it's which bad. Is like this, the center in Dallas, yeah. That's starting to feel the gentrification like really bad in Dallas.
See shirtless white dudes walk their tiny dogs.
The moment you like, start seeing the dog parks, you're like,
what? It's really trash, because I can feel like the cops are being used to police, you know, certain communities out of their own community. You know, I drive down the street and I saw like 10 people on the curb in handcuffs, and I'm like, mm-mm, what is this? And I saw some white guy walking his dog right across the street, and I was just like, what is this? Like, this is what the police, this is what police is for, honestly. This is what they're doing to the community. So it just, that hurt.
Yeah, no, yeah. Definitely. I, the one thing that I started to do, and it was other people were doing this, but I decided I was going to join in. I started tagging in the Mission. Or in San Francisco, but in the Mission specifically. And I started tagging like government buildings and spaces that weren't brown owned. And I started tagging Jota. That was my tag.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
And it was just my response. It was like one of the things that I felt like I needed to do was to claim this space, even though those tags would go down right away. But yeah, no, I definitely felt it. Definitely felt it back in the early 90s.
So that fury, you said you were already in film school around that time, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure like that fueled the inspiration a little bit more to sort of put that out into the media. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your inspirations to become a filmmaker and then maybe after?
Yeah. My whole move to San Francisco really changed the course of my life. When I was at Cal Berkeley, I was studying psychology and Chicano studies. I thought I was going to go on to grad school and go to psychology, the graduate program in psychology. I thought I was going to become a psychologist, always with an emphasis on POC communities. Like, I knew that. Like, when I was at Cal, I definitely came into my political identity, and I knew that it was something that I... that fueled my existence and helped me stay alive in many ways. But I wasn't sure exactly how I was going to engage our communities and in what way, what that work was going to look like. And then, you know, the whole psychology thing was something that actually I felt like people around me, including my parents, were sort of pushing me towards, because it was like, it was a career, you know what I mean? Yeah, it was an A to B kind of thing. And my brothers were already on that track of having sort of very American dreamish kind of careers. And so I was like, okay, I guess I'm going to do that. And so I couldn't afford to go straight to grad school. So I took a couple years off and ended up in San Francisco and ended up working at this organization that was organizing young people of color. And the focus of that program was really to to help young people see themselves as agents of change within their own communities. And so how do you do that? That's hard work, yeah. You know, like to see yourself as that agent and to be able to even, you know, tell the stories that you want to tell is very hard because we're not often asked what our stories are. We're not asked to participate in what solutions we might think might be something that we should exercise in our organizing. So we had to really do some personal work with the young people, and the ways that we help the young people sort of see themselves and understand these concepts were we had them engaging the arts to be able to talk about who they were, how they felt, to begin to tell their stories. And so I had been exposed to the arts when I was at Cal, but very few times was I engaging the arts directly, like myself. Mm-hmm. So here we were asking the young people to engage the arts and tell their stories, which is a very vulnerable thing to do. And we were like, yo, you know, we might be in our early 20s, but, you know, we shouldn't be adultists in this process. Like, why don't we also do this work as they're doing it, so they can see that we are also putting ourselves in this vulnerable position and we're also trying to figure this out. And so all of a sudden I started to make art with the purpose of self-healing, telling my stories, and taking these stories into our communities to see how people would engage, you know, what we were saying, engage the art and this very personal art. So those things just completely, like, my DNA just started to do some crazy shit and started to fall into place because I felt like Goyo Shauki in the way that I felt very broken, like I was trying to put myself together. And it wasn't really until I fell into that space where those pieces started to come together as a queer mujer, as an artist, as a daughter of immigrants, and the pressure that I felt to also provide for my family and achieve this American dream that they had, to expose myself as a queer woman, which I hadn't done yet. So, I mean, for multiple reasons, this space became really critical to who I am now. Because it was done in safe spaces, it was done with other POC people who were also, you know, trying to put themselves together, being very vulnerable in that process, and creating art to help us put ourselves together, going out into the community, engaging folks in dialogue around all this stuff. Like it was like super powerful stuff. I was definitely being born in those spaces. And I just fell in love with it all. I felt like it was my calling. Like, this is what I wanted to do. I wanted to be able to engage communities of color. I wanted to be a part of social change. I wanted to be a part of collective healing. And that's what I was doing. That's what I was experiencing firsthand, the power of that, the joy of that, the challenge of it. And I was like, man, this is it. It's lo que tengo que hacer con mi vida. And so that's where it all came together for me. That's where it all clicked. And I decided that I wanted to explore filmmaking and storytelling.
And I feel like all that healing you're talking about is exactly how I feel when I watch anything you've made, you know, Vietnamese Girl, Mosquito and Mari, it feels extremely healing to see other queer women exist in a space and not be sexualized, not be, you know, these caricatures of themselves. We are seen as full and whole, and it was extremely, everything you're describing about your process is exactly how I felt when I saw Mosquito and Mari, especially Vietnamese Girl, just because I was like, butch representation, I don't get to see this, and it reflects in your art, honestly. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time I saw myself represented at all as a queer Latina, as a queer Latinx person, excuse me, because I don't even really care about gender for me. Yeah. But that it was really beautiful. So it I reflects.
Yeah. Yeah, I think your story can resonate with a lot of people, especially like Latinx people in and queer Latinx people in media, especially because I think, like you said, the American dream, like, you don't go for filmmaking. When you're in high school, you don't think, like, oh, I can totally go to Hollywood. Like, I didn't think that. I didn't think I would be a film major until I was 2 years into college. And I was like, I don't want to do anything else. So I completely understand that feeling where it, like, falls together of, like, I have to do this. So that's a beautiful story.
And then there's that saying that was in Mosquito en Mani también, es que she's like, no vine a este país para... I'm sure she's like, no. She's like, no estoy todo el día en chinga. Oh, yeah. Que nomás estás, you know. I was like, oh my God, that's like being the child of an immigrant. It's see them every day in and out. And it's devastating to see how tired and exhausted they are. And then for you to just, you feel like you have to give them that American dream because it's also theirs. Like, you're not just walking around. That's being a child of an immigrant. You're not just walking around as yourself, as other people are privileged to walk in that. But if you're a child of an immigrant, you're holding the people that you love, the people that work for you on top of that, and you're walking with it. So that's...
It is. It's something that I definitely grew up with because I worked in that restaurant since I was 8 years old through Cal. So I saw my parents break their back every fucking day. Mm-hmm. My brothers and I did. And they didn't have to tell us anything. We saw it. Yeah. And the ivory tower was just 6 blocks away, Cal, staring at us, you know. And often they would be like, that's where you guys need to go. Like, wow. That's all they needed to say, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it's a tremendous amount of pressure to want to help your family. You know, to want to deliver that for them because you see, the exhaustion, the sacrifice for the family. So I think a lot of children of immigrants definitely carry that. That is real. Mm-hmm. And I struggled with that. I struggled to center myself and say, no, I want to be this filmmaker. And I equate it to coming out. I definitely felt like
immigrant parents?
Had to sit down.
Same thing.
So I had to come sit out down like 3 times.
I've come out several times to my parents, and it was hard every time. And you know, because I think that they're dealing with this unknown factor, this fear of like, oh my God, ¿qué va a pasar? You know, ¿qué va a pasar contigo? Like, it's just this worry of like, you're gonna suffer, algo te va a pasar, you know, from being queer to what does filmmaking mean? Like, that was their question. What does that look like? I had no idea.
Yeah, it's just, I guess, and it's understandable. Like, it took me a long time to understand that with my parents in particular, because it's like, they want to be able to protect you and lead you, and they can't do that if you're in, like, territory that they don't know.
Yeah.
So it's so hard on them. And I try to be understanding. I'm just like, oh, I know you don't like it, but I can't really do anything about it now.
And I think they just don't want you to struggle like they did, mm-hmm. period. They're just like, exactly. We don't want you
That's
to.
Why they came here. They're like, I don't want you to struggle like that, right?
Mm-hmm. But, you know, I had come out to them as being queer prior to me coming out to them being a filmmaker. So... I feel like when
those
I
are hard conversations.
Yeah, that was really, man. It was my early 20s kicked me in the ass, but you know, in good ways. But these were very hard conversations to have with my parents because I didn't come from a family where we sat down and talked. We didn't talk about shit,
right?
Likewise. Like, we live life, and you just don't process. It was just not something that we did in my home. So to sit down and have these conversations was incredibly challenging for me. But when I sat down to tell them about the filmmaking, they knew that I was doing this because it was real for me. Like, this, I'm coming to them, not joking around, not knowing. I knew that this was something that I needed to do, and either they needed to jump on the wagon or not. But I was going to go for it. Mm-hmm. And they just knew that that's the daughter that they had, that I go for shit. And so it was a really interesting moment for me.
That actually leads me to, it makes me think of Mosquito en Mani and the relationship between the parents and the daughters in both families, and how, like you're saying, they're not talking to each other. The one time that Mosquito, that Yolis tries to get something out of her mother, she's like, what? we're not doing that. She like immediately puts up this like brick emotional wall, and I'm just like, damn. It took me and my mom years to get to where we talk to each other like humans now, but the brick wall is a very, and I think about it in like ways of like trauma that they're not ever going to let you in on. Yeah. And that you just kind of have to accept that that's who they are, and they have to put that wall up to protect themselves. And I thought that was beautiful to see in Mosquito and Mari, because as I got older and I looked back at the movie, I was like, there's so much going on with the parents. Mm-hmm. Like, Mari's mom, immediately when she's flyering, she immediately goes to a man paying her. Like, she automatically thought that she was selling her body. It wasn't ever an option of her doing just labor. Mm-hmm. It was a different kind of labor automatically. And I just thought, what kind of trauma has she gone through? Mm-hmm. And I was just, wow, this is the layers there.
Yeah, yeah. There are a lot of layers there with the parents. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, when I was editing as a writer, there was a lot that I had to take out in that film. Mm-hmm. Because there was just too much in the original script that I had to pare back. And unfortunately, I had to pare back on the parents. But there was so much more story to them that I wanted to bring to the screen, and I couldn't. So I'm glad that people have connected to the parents and felt those layers, even though I wasn't able to give them more screen time, you know, so that's good.
Yeah, there was a lot underlying there. I think maybe we got left with a little bit of questions like, it could be this, but I think that's also, it's okay, because we can leave it to our own interpretations.
Yeah.
I think you did wonderful, by the way. you did absolutely fantastic. Yeah. I just watched it last night again.
Same. Yeah.
Thank you. I want to talk a little bit about after you figure out you're a filmmaker, go to grad school for filmmaking,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
What went on after that? How do you break in?
Yeah, that's hard.
I'm like,
how do you break in?
How did you,
that's
like,
that's
how
you
like
do it? My mom and dad. So how do you break in? I'm like, and my answer was no sé. Yeah, it was I feel like film schools have changed since I was in film school. So I graduated around 1999 from CalArts, great school, private art school. That was really focused on honoring the voice of the artist and really bringing that forward. And so I was really into that and really sort of not figuring out what my voice was. I knew what my voice was, but I needed a space to just be real about it, and they wanted me to be real about it. I wasn't going to another school where they were trying to shift who I was. And that was really key to me. But the downside, and still film schools can be like this, is that they don't really prepare you for how to sustain yourself once you graduate from
grad
school, right? And so, but, I feel like a lot of working class POC people, like that's their background, that they know you can't sit on your ass.
Mm-mm.
Until it comes to you. Like, you gotta fucking make things happen. So my brain was always reeling, like, okay, what am I gonna do? What am I gonna do? What am I gonna do? So when I graduated, I was already working. I was working in East LA at a full-time job to sustain myself through grad school. And I was working with community folks, and I met three queer mujeres from the East LA area who were also interested in the arts. And so we just started to have conversations about like what was the industry? You know, was there a place for us? We felt automatically no. You know, it's very white, male, straight, privileged space. You know, do we even want to be there? No. You know, we were like, no, like, we don't want to be there. Like, we were very clear about, let's just do our own stuff and create our own space and tell the stories that we want to tell. And we were all on the same page about wanting to center queer brown mujeres or queer POC folks. You know, because that's just what none of us had ever seen, right? And that's why we were coming into it, because that's what, you know, those were our stories, those are our identities. So we formed a collective, and the colectiva was called Mujeres, Women Image Makers, WIM. Together we started to make short films. while we each had our full-time jobs, organizing, community connected, always, all of us were always very much entrenched in how do we continue to help our comunidades, right? Whatever way we can. But really, we want to use the arts to be able to, you know, engage our communities, but that's hard. So let's just do our full-time job. And then on the side, we're doing this colectiva. And we ended up making a short film called Pura Lengua that was based on a personal story from one of the members of the group. And we set out to make it with not a big budget, pero juntas, always with this idea of like, let's surround ourselves with other queer POC people to make this film. Let's make it as a collective as much as possible, where not one person is driving the filmmaking, but we are as a group driving the filmmaking. Mm-hmm. And we made this film, and we decided to submit it to Sundance, and we got in.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. That's great.
Yeah, it was so that was a big deal. Mm-hmm. That was a big deal for us. That was a big deal for Sundance because they had never had queer, you know, Chicana with an X mujeres coming through Park City. Like, and we went, like, we rolled. Like, we had, like a lot of folks come through because it was a big deal. And so that opened up a bit of a door. It opened up a bit of a door for me because I was credited as the director. And Sundance is very director-focused. And so I, at the time, started to write Mosquita y Mari. And I was approached about the script, if I had anything else. Mm-hmm. And so I did. And I started to share the script. And I ended up getting into one of the labs at Sundance with the script. So things started to happen over mm-hmm. there, and we still continued to make work, the collective, and we made another short called Viernes Girl. Now that's the one that I wrote and directed for a competition that HBO was funding through the New York Latino Film Festival. And we won the award, and suddenly we're being produced by HBO. And this was a comedy. Pura Lengua is a very hard, in-your-face drama. Very unapologetic, brutal in many ways. And Viernes Girl was also saying something socially about gender, but it was a comedy. And it was very different. And it was fun for me to do something different than a drama. And so that garnered some attention because it was HBO. So, you know, so we, knock on wood, there were blessings there, you know, that we landed in these spaces where you could get some recognition. And so Mosquita y Mari, people started to ask, what do you have? And so it started to, you know, kind of surface as a feature that people were interested in producing. So at the same time that this was happening, I had a friend, a colleague from grad school, call me and tell me that she was leaving a job at a nonprofit called Film Independent. Film Independent is an awesome nonprofit that services emerging filmmakers. They provide workshops, programs, all this kind of stuff. And there is an awesome program at Film Independent called Project Involve. There are any emerging POC filmmakers, writers, directors, cinematographers, production designers, sound, everything. This is the program to look into because they accept, I think, 20, 25 filmmakers a year, all predominantly of color who are emerging. And you go through this sort of film schoolish type of thing where you go through a series of workshops to kind of talk about the craft. And you also get to make shorts together. And you're connected to this nonprofit, this bigger nonprofit of independent filmmakers. So this person called me, said, I'm leaving my job. I think you'd be good for it. I applied to the program, got in as a fellow, ended up getting hired to co-coordinate the program. And that was huge for me too, because then I was exposed to working independent filmmakers, people like Gina Prince Blythewood, Casey Lemons, I said Gregory Nava, and a bunch of other white filmmakers. A lot. But, you know, so this was a center where these filmmakers were somehow involved, either on the board, advisory board, or as mentors for Project Involve, because it's also a mentorship program. So it was huge for me to be exposed to independent working filmmakers of color, which I didn't know, none of us in our collective knew. So it was really interesting for me to see how they were shaping their careers. I was inspired. I was like, it was a wonderful place for me to land, to pay my bills, and to learn from my peers through the program, as well as, you know, the larger community of film independent and these independent filmmakers. So that combination of like the drive I had, the film collective I was a part of, and the environment that I was in at Film Independent is what helped me launch my career.
And that's where Mosquita y Mari kind of comes in, I imagine. That's when it, like, got people backing it and stuff like that.
Yes, it got into a few film programs, from Sundance to Tribeca. And those labs helped develop the script. So I worked writing that script for about 11 years on and off. Whew. Yeah, it's on and off. It was quite a labor of love for multiple reasons. It was the first time I was screenwriting. I was not trained to write at grad school. It was a very personal story. That originally was a story that took place from first grade to graduating high school. Oof. It was an episodic story. And so so in this process of writing, I was learning how to write. I was learning how to condense the story to be able to produce it, because it was just really hard to produce at the time. And I was also living life, you know. I had to work, and I had drama in my life that often deterred me from, you know,
telling your story.
Yeah, you from the, what I was story. Supposed to be doing. I was derailed a few times, and not that it was not of my doing. I was derailing myself often.
Yeah,
but you know, as young, and
you gotta learn.
Wild.
That's relatable too.
I feel that right
so,
now.
So you know, so those 11 years were like a combination of a lot of things, but yeah. So Mosquita Mari was brewing during that time, and I was being guided by some of these programs that were offering mentorship and stuff.
And the phone rings.
I wonder how you turn it off.
Is that Queen Latifah calling?
It might be.
She found out so fast.
I think she knows. So I want to talk a little bit about this kind of really beautiful cycle that I noticed, where you went in, you like pretty recently worked with Ava DuVernay on Queen Sugar, mm-hmm. and she has since then kind of recommended you a lot and really, mm-hmm. really praised you a lot. Well deserved, of course.
Yes.
And from that, she recommends you to direct a music video for Lin-Manuel Miranda. You bring in Ginés Piñeda from Mosquita y Mari, and it's just, and then you connect with Raúl Castillo, like this beautiful cycle of just like POC filmmakers and actors, like all working together and creating this community. Like, that's going to be an amazing experience.
Yeah, it is. It's wonderful to be a part of what I feel is a growing community of POC artists who are taking the time to see each other and be like, I see you. Like Ava's like, I see you. Mm-hmm. I see what you got. Not a lot of people want to see it for whatever fucked up reasons, but I see it. I'm in a position of power to hire, to whatever, open up some doors. And I want to bring you along because I believe in you. Like, she is an example of what is happening. There are other people that are functioning, working like that. And I don't, you know, I know that I come from a background that thinks about community, that understands that your success is my success. Like that is, that was always been my slogan and has been slogan for a lot of POC communities that do social justice work, that are artists, you know, that aren't individualistic, that aren't like, oh, the carrot is dangling in front of me, I'm gonna grab it for me because it's mine. That is really shifting, and it is shifting with my generations and the generations that are coming up under me. And so I am living it. Like, I'm blessed to be living it with someone like Ava and other people around me that have opened up doors for me. And I am also exercising that with, you know, when I'm in positions of being able to bring on board POC people, I do it. I mean, it, you know, that I feel like I get hired because they know that those are the lenses I see the world through. So if I'm going to cast, I'm going to cast, you know, POC people. I'm going to bring folks on board. And that's basically how that happened on this music video. You know, that because I had to pitch the story. Like, it wasn't something that was pitched to me.
They were just like, this song.
Well, yeah. I mean, Lin-Manuel Miranda was like, I guess he reached out to Ava and was like, I don't know if he reached out to her to direct the music video or if he was like, who do you know who's out there? And then she was like, do you know Aurora? He's like, no. She's like, you need to know her. So then they reached out to me, the label, and said, hey, Ava's told us about you. We want to do a music video for this song with Andrew Day as the artist. Can you come up with a concept, pitch it, and then we're going out to other artists and we'll see what happens. Mm-hmm. So in pitching that story, of course I'm going to pitch, you know, POC story.
Of course.
I probably could have queered the story too, but
I mean, I thought about
didn't
that.
Queer
it's
the
okay.
story.
It's okay. I thought about that.
I still thought it was a great story.
Like, I was like, so okay, good. Like, who's she not who, but is it a man or is it what's going on? Is Raul Castillo queer? Like, is she queer? Like, who's queer here?
Everybody's like waiting for the queer shoe to drop. Yeah.
In my mind, the, you know, Mosquita, I forget her name, but yeah, Mosquita and Vanessa and the woman who helped the lady who was in trouble, they're both queer.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
That's in my mind.
Because, I mean, only a queer woman could be the empathetic on a train stop. She was like, yes, here, right here.
That's
beautiful.
That's our aesthetic, so.
It is our aesthetic.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think that I just have to honor what stories come to me organically, and because sometimes the characters that speak to me are male, a male-identified, you know, cis character that I'm like, okay, this fool is talking to me, has a story to tell, and I try to honor that. It's a really weird way to talk about writing, and maybe you can identify in that way, but sometimes it happens like that, where you just have this story that someone is in your ear talking to you about, and you just start putting pen to paper and writing about it. And so, and of course, it's coming from some personal experiences, but you know, you never know who's telling you that story or whose POV it's supposed to be through. And this story came to me, and the central part of that story was the way these two women hold space for this woman in a public arena. And that one of them was older and one of them was younger. Like, that was the heart of this story. And that's
brown,
what I had to honor.
Brown
it.
And black community.
And
that
it
was beautiful.
Brown and black, you know, where I'm like, okay, we have a brown brother who is not being faithful to his partner, who's a black woman. But here I have an older black woman and a young brown girl holding this space for her to have those feelings and to heal. And so, you know, so it was kind of flipping that around a little bit. So it was, you know, there is no queer person, but I always, you know, but queer can be anything, you know what I mean?
It's a queer lens.
It's a queer lens, and so
we felt it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you can still connect with what's going on. Like, everybody goes through trauma with their partners. You know, like, I don't think that queer people won't connect with that. I think I connected with it.
Yeah,
it's all just about seeing humanity, and
right?
Empathy, and you can do that.
Yeah,
anywhere. We can do that anywhere.
It was great.
It was beautiful.
I loved it. I watched it last night again, too.
I had a lot of fun with that, It's just hyper-visual. And it's also a very emotional story, but I love just being able to tell visual stories, so.
Was there anything super memorable to talk about that happened during shooting or writing?
Well, I mean, I had the awesome privilege of working with such a strong cast, and that was really amazing. Raul Castillo, whose career is really blowing up, he was my choice, and so they went out to him, and he was like, Aurora Guerrero's involved. I love Mosquita y Mari. Hell yeah, I'll fly myself out, because there was no budget. There was no budget to this. And he's in New York. Like, very generous, very giving, a beautiful heart, sweetheart. Mm-hmm. And it was a crazy shoot. The budget was very low. I had a day to do it.
What?
Yeah.
You had a day?
Yeah.
That's a day.
I had a day to do it, but it turned into 2 days.
Okay.
Because the big story was, so we have this train, the metro station to shoot, right? So we plan it for a particular time in the evening because the trains aren't running and we're able to take over a platform. So my producers had set this up with Metro, and we were going super fast because time goes like this on film shoots. And God bless Raul Castillo's soul, who, you know, didn't have a lot of time with his scenes because we're moving so fast, and he flew out and everything. And we just jammed through his stuff, and he was just so awesome about it. Everybody was really awesome about it. But I take off from having just directed his stuff to the metro station. We get to the metro station, and my producers are like, there's no train. And I was like, what do you mean there's no train? There's no train. They fucked up. Oof. They're doing maintenance.
No.
And I was like, what? And usually, you know, your wheels are spinning. Okay, what's the solution? And I literally was like, I cannot produce a train out of thin air. Like, this is a problem, people. Like, you know. And so I ended up with a second day to shoot the train stuff, which was another blessing. Mm-hmm. Because we were running behind. But yeah, that was my big story on that shoot.
I'm glad that you got that second day.
Oh, me yeah. too. Yeah. But everybody was wonderful. All the actors were just knocking it out of the park. So
that's great. That's great.
Uh-huh.
Oh, amazing. My goodness. Wow, we're getting like everything.
All the lowdown.
Yeah. We want to get into Mosquita y Mari a little bit, okay. if you're down.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about, I guess, the decision to have such a large contrast between Mosquita and her mom and dad and Mari and her mom. Like, was there a purpose behind them being just completely on different spectrums?
In terms of the families? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that I wanted to acknowledge that we all come from different homes and different situations, and literally that can be your neighbor, you know, like someone across the street who might look like you in some ways can be very different in terms of the context that they're coming from. And I just wanted to acknowledge that, so I wanted to make that contrast very clear. And in terms of, like, I made the choice to go with Mari being undocumented and Mosquita being documented. And it was something that actually was born out of the relationship that I built with the community of Huntington Park, Southeast Los Angeles, where a lot of the young people and the advisors around the project were talking about how there were a lot of undocumented young people in the area. And the more they would talk about it, the more I felt that representing that was important. And so, you know, so things kind of grew out of stuff that I wanted to do, as well as the relationship that I was having with this community and really listening to what the young people were saying and what was important to represent. So it was coming from those things that I really wanted to show that contrast.
I always talk to her about that too, is that how your use of community, I wish more current shows on TV that are getting a lot of praise would talk to the community instead of going into the community in a space that they're not from and trying to portray it, and it feels false.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of work that you put into it, and you took from the, you not took, You got advice from the community. You included the community. And it's so different to versus taking from the community and including the community, which is what you did. And I honestly wish more storytellers, more creatives now, present day, no shade to some other things I'm talking about, but shade to them because they don't, you know, include the community.
What do you think is the obstacle there? Like, how come you were able to do it very genuinely and very well?
She's an activist.
Yeah, of course. So I know that's definitely a big
just writers.
I think it's just the awareness, you know, understanding that I know that many people have come into communities that I belong to in the Bay and have told stories about our community and gone off and claimed it as their own. And this is a legacy, right? This has happened historically. It's a colonial practice. That is a colonial practice, right? So I, as, you know, a conscious person, as an Indigenous identified person, I don't want to practice colonial ways of being. So I try not to, whatever I form, be in a hierarchical situation. I try to create as much collectivity as possible, which is very against sort of how Hollywood works.
Yeah.
But that's how the collective that I was a part of, that I mentioned, really was conscious about that stuff. And really looking at privilege, right? Like what privileges I have, because I was once that young person from these a working class community of color who had folks come in and tell stories and go off. So I don't want to repeat that. So I just, I feel that, you know, like I think that that's something that to me is important to be conscious of, right? So when I could not tell Mosquitay Mari's story in the Bay Area, which was, it was originally set in the Bay, I could not do it because I could not afford it. So then I had to come to LA, or I was already in LA, but I had to bring the story here. And I wanted to do it in the Huntington Park area and realized, well, I'm not from this neighborhood, right? So how am I gonna just step into this neighborhood, tell this story, and walk off? Like, it just, this isn't like the, even though there's similarities to, say, the Mission District to Huntington Park, they're completely different. They have a different history, different way that they came about. So I was like, I don't know that story. I got to talk to people to get that story, right? Because I want to ground it in the truth of this community. So how do I do that? I engage people in conversation, right? So that was my thinking. And I was already connected to folks in Boyle Heights who are social justice workers. And so I had asked them, do y'all have any contacts in Southeast LA, specifically in Huntington Park, that I can connect with? And they were like, yeah, I got a compadre. And he works for this nonprofit, Communities for a Better Environment, that's been around for a long time. They've got a good reputation. Why don't you start there? And that's what I did. And in that process, I was like, all right, here I am coming in, having knowledge. This is my privilege. I have knowledge how to tell stories with a film, right, with a camera. So I'm coming into this working class poor community. I'm assuming that most of the young people here don't have that, those skills, don't have access to that knowledge. So there's a privilege that I got. I'm like, okay, so I'm walking in here. I want to hear their stories so I can better entrench this story in a sense of truth. What am I going to give them in turn? You know what I mean? So that's how I was thinking, like, how can this be a mutual thing of, you know, giving, taking, and growing together? And so when I approached Roberto Cabrales, who was my main contact at Communities for a Better Environment, we talked about that. Like, how can I give back what y'all are giving me? Because I know what you guys are giving me is huge. You know, it's your corazón, it's your soul, this is your home. Like, what can I do? And he was like, well, you need to talk to the youth first to get their blessings. They had a youth component. that was very fierce, mm-hmm. and I was really scared.
As they are,
as the most youths. Young people are. I came from that, from San Francisco Bay Area, and I know young people are fierce. So I was like scared to pitch the film, but he was like, let them tell you what makes sense and stuff. And so that's what I had to do. I had to pitch the idea, get their blessing, and then they turned around and were like, well, we want to tell our own stories too. Like, we get what you're trying to do, and we love what you're trying to do, and we're going to support you. But you know what? We should be telling our stories too. And I was like, yep, I get it. That's why I'm doing what I'm doing. So then we talked about ways to be able to bridge whatever knowledge I had with what it was they wanted to learn. So we started this very hands-on mentorship program while we were shooting, in prep and in shooting. So we had young people, like, we started application process, everything. Young people from Southeast LA had to apply. And the young people who were sort of the core of this group of young people that were supporting me created the application. And we brought young people on board each department that, you know, that a film has, which is production design, cinematography, producing, directing. Whatever young people were interested in, those were the departments that they landed in. And each department head had to mentor. Wow. And so when I put the film together, I would have to have that conversation with the department head. So if you want this job, the other big part of this is that you have to mentor. But of course, I'm going to work with people and be like, yeah, we get it. Like, we're hella down. So we had a large group of young people from Southeast LA being mentored. And it wasn't just we're just giving our knowledge to them. On set, they were like, they were telling us shit that was just like awesome, you know, where a location would like close down. We're like, oh my God, we just lost that location. They're like, oh no, my deal is over there. And wow. We got a rooftop we can go to, and we know this way to sneak in, and you know. And it was just like really beautiful. And so Mosquita y Mari really is what you feel, that texture you feel, that taste of authenticity that you like is just so vivid, is that. It's that relationship that we built together. I had a blast doing that work. Like, it was just like, I just got so much out of it. And I think that people are nervous about that process because there's this control issue of like, well, how much of my story is going to change? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, now I have to kind of go through them to get the okay. And I get that. But me, like, I feel like my script just grew. It wasn't set in the 80s. It became modern. You know, the Mari's character grew a lot. There was just so much that I was able to get to enrich Mosquita y Mari from that. Never at any point was it a negative experience. It was amazing. And I came out of that with clarity that was the type of filmmaker that I'm meant to be. You know what I mean? So whatever I am at the root creating, not a TV show that I'm being hired to guest direct because I have no power, not a lot. But anything else that's really coming from something that I'm planting from the very beginning, that's the type of approach that I want to engage, you know, to be able to tell these stories. Because I saw the impact. A lot of those young people went on to go to film school.
That's great.
Yeah. So it was really impactful. And I really do encourage other writer, directors, producers to think about their responsibilities and not to be afraid to have these conversations. I don't think community is trying to tell you what kind of storyteller you need to be or rewrite everything. Like, they're just coming with a lot of honesty and truth. And if you're not ready to hear it, then you know, you're not going to engage in this process. But it is well worth it, and I think that it's an approach that that we could really benefit from. So, and really challenge that other practice that, you know, that people have. So
It baffles me that more directors don't work like this, or writers don't work like this, because I do hear a lot from writers having that control issue. I'm sure I would suffer from it if I wrote more, but or if I had more in the works. But yeah, it's hard to give up your creative, you know, like people always complain like, oh, I don't want notes from producers and all that. It's understandable because this is just, they're just business people, but notes from the community that you're writing about, like it makes all the sense in the world to go talk to them. Like, it's gonna, there's no way that they could negatively affect your story. They're gonna make you better.
Yeah,
like that's such an, and I hope that all writers take that advice a lot more, because that's like Fredovita says, like a lot of people are not doing that.
Yeah,
a lot. Yeah,
I mean, and we're in this new wave of like diversity in media, and it feels like tokenism versus actual representation, which I wish, you know, they'd take a page out of your book and put some authenticity in it. And you can feel it when you watch it. And but leading back to that, is there anyone that you feel is somewhat doing that now, like at all, making media today?
Yeah, well, I mean, what happens is you don't often hear about the backstory of how people are telling their stories,
yeah,
and creating their art. So I can't say that I can speak to anyone who's doing that. I'm sure it is happening, and that there are certain filmmakers that are practicing some sort of version of what I'm thinking about. But I can't offhand say, oh, I know this person, that person. You know, there's a lot of people that don't know how I went about Mosquita y Mari.
Now they do. We're gonna have to.
Yeah, now they do. We're gonna spam this link to them.
Send this to your director friends. Send this to your writer friends right now,
please.
It's like a guide. I'm gonna listen to it back and forth, like over and over again. But
step one. This is the manual.
So I can't. I'm hoping, and I believe that other people are thinking about this for sure.
No, we're seeing it in a different way, and seeing it manifest differently too. Like, we talk about how, you know, in order to see yourself or to see some kind of authentic representation, there's someone has to be putting someone else on. So I always lead back to like Lena Waithe, mm-hmm, and the kind of positivity she's spreading right now is that I key in on like people that are actively doing the work to say, no, I'm going to tell my story, and we should tell our own stories,
yeah,
and it should be done this way. And,
yeah,
you know, to see a queer Black woman do that, to see a queer Latinx person do the same thing, it just it blows my mind, and it makes me, I don't know, I guess I might even say
hopeful?
Optimistic.
What is this feeling? It's tingling.
Yeah, I'm like, I don't know. I've never felt that right now. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of it.
Honestly, the government should work that way, too. The way you do your filmmaking, the government should do that. And instead of kicking out immigrants, take them in. Let them tell you what we need to do.
It's just working from, like, this, like,
oh, yeah,
anti-colonization. Like, just decolonize everything. Like,
yeah,
fuck it. Like, the whole basis of the way the United States came to be, the way that we're function in the United States, the way capitalism functions, is just, it's not working, and it's starting to show. And I really, really like that people are expressing themselves now, and they're feeling empowered to do so. So,
mm-hmm,
and thank you so much for Mosquita y Mari.
To kind of wrap up on Mosquita y Mari, and there's a couple of points that we wanted to hit that we're probably going to have to do that really fast, but female desire. What was the inspiration to kind of talk about that over like a lot? Because I know like that's a big part of it, is them being like, oh, I see her. You know what I mean? Like, I am connecting here. What is this?
Well, because I feel like that's something that I didn't really see like represented at all in media. That desire, that gaze, particularly with women of color. And I think that it's such a big part of my story, and I think a lot of people's story, where that desire just kind of sits with you and doesn't always have an outlet to, like a direct vocal outlet to play off of. And so I feel like many POC queer people sit in that desire, and it just stews and stews and stews and comes out in different ways, the unspoken, the gazes, the touches that you know, I really wanted to focus on those things because they say so much, right? And so I know a kiss says a lot, but most of us don't get there. Most of us are in this place where the desire has been kept under wraps for different reasons. And so I wanted to tell the story of how this brewing desire has its own language, and to really capture that and talk about the context in which that happens. Like, why is that desire not being articulated? Why is it manifesting in certain ways? And looking at the intersection of like class, gender, ethnicity, todo eso. So I think that's why I really focused on this desire bit. And it's a very, very personal story for me. It is, I still, not that I'm brewing in it, like, because I want it, but that story has still not ended in my life. Like, she is still, we have still yet to have a vocal conversation about what that was and what happened. So it's a combination of the very personal, but also looking at that space of desire, and how it plays out in POC lives, in our intersectional lives.
It's so underrated how like important it is for like queer, like Latinx youth to see something like that. I didn't see it until I was like in my early 20s, but if I had seen that when I was like going through this gay 15, rage 16? As a 15-year-old,
15, 16, wow,
I think I would have like felt so like you know, a lot more
validated.
There you go. I would have felt so much more validated. Yes. And instead, I was just angry.
Yeah, I mean, you live in this world that is that, you know, you wonder if anyone sees you, if what you're feeling, if what is happening is happening. You know what I mean? Like, you just don't know anything. And that's part of being young and a teen and having that angst. But I just really wanted to say to all those budding queer brown people out there, yes, that is queer, motherfuckers. That is queer. I have had so many people in audiences get up and go, you've just made me re-examine all of my friendships, and I think I was queer and did not know it until now. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I just really, that's me naming it without naming it, me saying that, yes, that is what it was. That is what it is. And it makes people uncomfortable, especially older people.
Oh,
who are like, really?
They're used to like stuffing it down.
They're like, wait, I wanna keep it there. I've been suppressing this.
Yeah.
Like, am I queer at 60? Like, yes, you probably are. It's okay.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Man. Oof. Let's get into a little bit, because we a little bit touched on this just a little bit, but where did you first see yourself represented on the media, if ever?
Always ask that, like, yeah.
Or before you created media, did you see yourself at all?
I did. I mean, I didn't see myself, but I did see films that had brown people at the front of the camera and behind the camera, which is really the, like, the Gregory Naba films, from
Mi Familia.
Mi Familia, to We Had El Norte, though they were immigrants, but more like the Mi Familia type of stories. La Bamba.
Oh, yeah.
That's a big one. Classic. For a lot of people.
Yeah, La Bamba. And we were all so bummed out when we found he was Filipino. And it was like, okay, it's cool. But we totally thought you were Chicano.
He played that off.
He played that really well. He did a great job. But... yeah, so most of those films were very male identified, strong male lens. The women were, for the most part, very one dimensional, either the suffering mother, the oversexed, you know, prostitute, or you were a gangster, like in Echo Park. What was that movie called with Echo Park Mujeres?
One with like Sad Girl. And
yeah.
I know what you're, Mi Vida Loca.
Mi Vida Loca.
Yeah.
So you were a criminal young person, you overly sexualized. So basically for me, I was completely invisible. I was nowhere in there at all. And neither was my family. Right. Like most of the people around me were like, where are they? Like, those are cool people, but we don't know them. You know what I mean? Like,
who's that? Like, I don't
really
know her.
Really invisible. Absolutely nothing around queer stuff at all.
Oh, gosh. To this day, most
I think the first queer things, they were all white. You know?
Like, they were very, 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 very white.
Not that it isn't today.
There was like Go Fish. I think Go Fish was like my first.
Watermelon Woman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Watermelon Woman. And then Go Fish. Mm-hmm. And I just was like, respect to those filmmakers, those storytellers are telling their stories. But I still don't see myself there. I'm like, that's not me and the people around me. So that invisibility just kept growing and growing. And it was definitely fueling this anger inside of me to want to change that, and so that's what I set out to do. So it was in response to that, like what I was seeing was not coming close to anything that I could relate to at all. Especially, you know, a lot of the work that I'd done was with young people, and I was like, yo, we are doing such a disservice to our youth in media, like, you know, that just putting them in these categories of, like, again, being criminalized or over-sexualized or just not having anything to contribute. Like, just not really thinking for themselves, being intelligent, complex, funny, nothing. And we definitely, I had never seen a young person's love story. Even straight, like, young love. Ever.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't really seen that.
PLC, yeah.
So I, you know, I grew up with the John Hughes stuff. I grew up with Pretty in Pink, you know, all of that. And it was as white as hell.
Yes.
And if there was a person of color, they were hell of, like, the representation was so problematic.
So
it was ridiculous. I mean, it's overt, right? It's like hella racist.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So I was like, we deserve to have our love stories. I'm going to tell one of our love stories. This is it. It's only one. But it was the one that was very close to me. So I think about that. I'm like, what do we need? We need our love stories, you know? Complex love stories.
We deserve that, you know? We're given queer pain. We talk about it all the time. That all we see is, oh, did someone die? did they go back to a man? Like, how does this work? Like, they get the lowest ratings, especially if they're white. Which, sadly, a lot of them are white. But it's cool. It's all right.
Mm. Is there anything today that I think you've been impressed by representation wise anything or recent in general?
Let's see. Well, I love I think Atlanta's really good.
Atlanta's fantastic.
Amazing.
I mean, it's through a male lens, but I think the men are super complicated, and you think you get something, you know, based on the surface, and then they're so not that, and I love that. And I think that the character of his girlfriend is really getting more screen time and is really interesting. And so, and artistically, it's very creative. And I'm mad props to the creative team behind that show. But I think that's a great show. Insecure is really funny and also really interesting.
It's healing.
It's very healing. And you know that she is not afraid to go there with certain issues, and I think it's, you know, I think it's great. The Queen Sugar is also, even though I directed on that show, I think it's also an awesome show. Shout out to them. So yeah, I think that there's stuff coming out that we have a show, maybe it's them. It's a reboot, but the One Day at a Time.
One Day at a Time is wonderful.
Yeah, I think that they're also doing a really great job at exploring the life of a brown family. And so, I think that that's great, but it's one of the few.
Yeah.
In terms of like,
it's one of the few
Latino Latina representation out there. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, there are other shows, but I think One Day at a Time is definitely one where.
It's fantastic. We've done 2 episodes on that one. That's the only one that's gotten 2 episodes out of us. Yeah. And I was like so lucky. I got to go to a couple of tapings over the summer.
Yeah.
And they're just, they're fantastic. They're just
so what talented. What do you all want to see? I'm taking note.
Ideally,
happy queer brown women. Just happy.
Happy.
Like, not badass queer brown pain. Women. I don't want to.
I want to see badass ones that go and like fight crime. You know what I mean? Like, I want America Chavez live action.
Yeah.
You know, that's the kind of stuff
that
I
would
want.
Be fucking badass.
God, yeah, they're doing like a cartoon version, which is fine, I guess. But her starring like in something would be amazing. Just like really strong and not like, because not very emotional. I'm not very emotional. So, like, you know, stoic women. You know?
More stoic women.
Like, stoic women who are badass, who have, like, you know, all this stuff. I don't know, all the stuff that I should probably be writing myself.
Yeah, do it.
Might okay. while you're editing this, can you get to work?
Because note to self.
Note to self, get back to writing. Okay,
there you go.
I want happy queer brown women.
Speaking of working on new stuff, is there anything that you can tell us about that you're currently working on?
Yeah, I mean, I'm developing 2 projects right now. They're very, well, one is a little further than the other, but there's one for television and one for film. And the one for film is least developed, so I can't say too much about it, but I can't wait to make another film.
Oh, yeah.
I'm really, really yearning and missing that space. And the one for television would be an episodic love story between two brown, like a brown and black woman set in the Bay in Richmond, California.
I have this, oh my God.
It's a working class.
Oh my God.
A story that starts with them in their 40s, and they've been out of each other's lives since high school, but they were each other's love, and they are separated and have not been in contact for about 15-20 years, and then they come back into each other's lives accidentally, and they've already have their own lives. One of them is married, has a child, and the other one is in a relationship, and they accidentally reconnect and their lives sort of go upside down from there. So I'm exploring that concept of love again, in the lives of 2 women who, weren't given that opportunity to really explore it as intensely as they wanted to, and then are faced with that in their 40s. And it's a drama, so they're happy and they're sad.
I'll take it.
I'm excited about it. I think that there's a lot of potential there to explore different issues. It's kind of like the idea of if you think about Mosquita y Mari,
unofficial sequel.
Like, oh, it's kind of like the sequel in the sense of like, okay, so you know, I left them at this crossroads, right? And so what happened, they went off to live their own lives, and then they come back together when they're in their early 40s, and what happens?
That's amazing.
So but really wanting to explore the black and brown communities like together, the nuances of those relationships between the black and brown community, because I grew up very much entrenched in that, coming from the Bay, and it's always been a big part of my life, so I want to honor that through this show. And I think we need that.
Oh yeah,
we
I can't think of any media that is exploring that. And Fred Papita grew up in a majority like African American community.
It's black community.
As did I for a big portion of my life. There's so much to talk about there.
Yeah.
Like, and we don't. Latinos in general just don't talk about anti-blackness enough.
Yes.
And
it's weird for me, right? Weird for us.
Like, yeah, for like, us, what? We're like, what are you, not... like, don't do that, mom. Like, you know? Yeah. Thing. Come on.
Oh, no. Like, Lord. My friends, the things they'd say.
And the
like,
friends,
I can't be
too.
Around you. You ain't my friend no more. Like, yeah. I've
stopped being friends with so many people because they were white passing Latinos who, like, when you're white passing, no offense to you, Maita, no offense to you, but like a lot of white passing Latinos, I give her trash talk for all this.
No,
it's okay.
Go on.
You know, you're the exception.
It's fine.
No, but a lot of them, you know, it's this inherent anti-blackness, and it's just from them and their family. I'm like, I can't be around you. You don't
it's
see
it's definitely
you, like,
embedded in their family.
Embedded.
I see it in my family.
And it makes no sense.
I'm white passing, but my family's white passing, like more than me.
Oh, my Mexican and family, I don't talk to for the same reason.
I talk to them. They're my family.
But Mexico, I have to read them. I'm like, oh, excuse me, honey.
Yeah, like, yeah. That's it's like a new holiday practice of mine where I'm like, you shouldn't say that because of A, B, C, D.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, so, that's nice of you. I don't say it like that, but that's nice of you. I say it a different way.
I don't, you know, try to reason with people.
Yeah. And I mean, I think there's been a long history of black and brown relationships, and we hardly ever get it explored. And there's definitely... What does get media attention is when there's conflict between the black and brown community. Mm-hmm. We don't often see how we work through that, what the solidarity can look like, or what love can look like, family, biracial families can look like. And yeah, I just really miss that. That was a big part of my life too, my love life too. So I just, I'm going for it.
That's
I'm
gonna
great. Do this. It's called, amazing to see.
It's called Loveland. So.
Any way that we can support, like, let us know. We'll promote it all day long.
Just the encouragement and the buenas vibras to keep
you're,
writing.
If you're ever, like, at a writer's block, just
yes.
call me.
Yeah, my best to be the one.
Yeah. What are you working on?
I haven't worked on much in a long time because I write articles and stuff
okay.
like that. So I've just kind of been working on that kind of stuff and on the mostly doing a lot of research because I have to research a lot for this podcast. The last thing that I wrote was like a sci-fi. It was a sci-fi
nice.
Where based in Mexico in like a dystopian society where basically the U.S. had closed itself off to the rest of the world and aliens landed in Mexico. It was just
nice.
Yeah, so... That was the last thing that I, like, the last long project that I did.
That was a feature?
No, it was actually, like, a 60-minute drama.
Oh, okay.
For TV, yeah. But...
That's exciting. Yeah. Well, we need more brown writers writing genre stuff, you know, from the action to the sci-fi to the horror to, like...
Yeah,
we need all of that.
Yeah.
I love all of that. Like I can't wait to be able to direct something that I mean I tend to write drama or dramedy, but I would love to direct something that is genre like that. You know,
America Chavez. America Chavez. Yeah, saying
yeah,
it out there.
Marvel.
Seriously,
can't wait. What's odd is that I don't write, but me and my homegirl, we've been talking about the same thing about how black and brown communities need. We don't see it, and that's our reality, and we've lived it our whole lives, and so we get drunk all the time, and we talk about, like, you know, she'll write something that's, like, she'll send it over to me, like, 3 a.m, and I send it right back to her at 4 a.m, and we just kind of in conversation with each other, and we really just want to see art, because, like you said, it's our reality, and we're not seeing it, and everything we do is, like, even what you do is very, like, punk. It's very, like, DIY. I'm going to do it myself. I don't see it. I'm going to create it. The same thing. It's how Cabronas y Chingonas was made. It was, like, I just read a bunch of white boys reading reviews about, you know, POC media, queer media. I'm like, they're not even queer. Like, what is this? And so that's how we were made. And that's how I feel like me and Halissa, shout out Halissa, we're probably going to do something like that, too, because we've been writing for years, and we just don't even... We wouldn't even know where to begin and where to put it, you know?
Yeah.
But we've been in conversation for years, and it's about time we finally did it.
Yeah. So. I'm so glad that you're saying that, because I think that that's a beautiful, sound advice that we could impart to folks out there who are like, "What? How do I do this? What do I do?" I think it is channeling that punk spirit to just go for it. And, like, it is hard. I'm not saying it's all going to – it's just going to all happen for you because it's complicated. There's a lot of factors out there that are working, you know, to block us. But we also can't wait for other folks to tell our stories. Mm-hmm. And we are creative, smart people that – either alone or together, we can create some powerful stuff. And I encourage that because we need to. We need to hold on to that spirit. We need to, make shit happen. We really, really do. And now, now is the time more than ever to do that. So
that's fantastic. So I was about to ask you what advice you have for other creatives. That was it.
Telling you, she answered all my questions.
Oh, that's fantastic.
She answered all of mine.
That's great. I mean, the industry has changed so much just even in like the last 10 years. Like getting into television in particular is like impossible these days. But I'm gonna take this entire episode honestly as inspiration and advice because I think there's so many people out there that are jumping into the creative space because digital media has changed a lot for everybody. And yeah, like you said, I also encourage other people to try to kind of go for it because I didn't know what I was doing 3 years ago. Now I know how to run a podcast. Like, you can learn.
It's absolutely. It's the knowledge is out there. You know, you can Google it or YouTube it or just pick up a phone or text someone. And if you want the knowledge, it's out there. Take it, apply it, create. And I think that there's more room for us to continue to.
Yeah, and we're here because of community too, our little community. So shout out Joe, shout out Halissa,
shout out to Support Brown Podcast.
Support Brown Podcast,
that's right.
We're here because of other people because we're all in this together. We're working together. We want their success as our success. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. It's never hate. It's always love.
So. Which, in that spirit, do you have anyone or that you want to plug, or is there any social media you want to plug, projects, things we should be watching, anything that you want to shout out at all?
I mean,
even your own social media.
No, I'm on social media, but off and on. Like, I'm very inconsistent. but I just want to shout out to all the POC filmmakers and white allies that are out there in the industry, independent television, who are really trying to shift the culture of this industry and make it a lot safer for people, a lot more conducive for a variety of perspectives to take form and take shape and rise, who are just kicking ass as storytellers, from the Lena Whites and Ava DuVernays to the Ryan Cooglers to the Alex Riveras to a bunch of people. Cheryl Denier, who we mentioned, is also rocking it out there. And so I just want to plug those people that they have really awesome hearts, and they're really trying to practice a way of filmmaking that is slightly different. They're telling stories that are really interesting, and giving other people opportunities. Like, support them, support their work, their storytelling, their social media. So I just want to say thank you to all of them and everything they're doing, because it inspires me every day.
For sure. I mean, I think we can say the same thing about
you.
That's
how we feel about you. Yeah.
Honestly. Thank you. Like, it's just that your name is back in the media is like making us so happy recently. We're like, yes, she's killing it. Especially Fred Bobito is like super fan.
I'm super fan. Like, I don't know how many times I've told people, I'm like, but have you seen Mosquita Mari? Like, you ain't really about it, okay? Get out of my face. Like, that's not, no, you're not about it. You got to walk in it. And then once you do, you're like, wow. Shocking, a concept,
Now you can talk to me.
Yeah, now they're allowed to talk to me. Yeah. But it's your work, honestly. It centers me. It was healing for me. And thank you so much. It's meant so much to me. And since 2011, before I was in very much in the closet until now. And it's meant a lot. It's helped me get to who I am. So it's very healing. I can't even. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that.
All right, Aurora, thank you so much for being on the show. We are actually really shook that you're here right now.
Of course, I'm a fan. So I was like, aww. I was like, I wonder if they're ever going to invite me to their show.
God, we always
And then I got the email. I was like, what? Yes! Of course.
Yeah, we wanted to a long time ago, but we're long distance, so yeah. It was tough. And I was just like, okay, so I'm sorry. You need to fly out here like immediately.
And she was like, she said yes. I was like, I'm flying out. I was like, girl, just tell me the day. I will miss work. I will miss a baptism. Oh, it don't matter. I'm there.
What a bad
You know what that means. Yeah. You gotta be there for those, okay? I almost missed a baby shower. It was very real. It's very real.
I'm honored. Thank you so much for thinking of me. This means a lot to me. And I really do hope that y'all continue doing this work. It's really important that we also, you know, have a space to be critical, not just celebrating, but critical of the work that we're doing. You know, so we can continue to grow and be stronger artists in the world. So
thank you. We plan to be here and we hope to have you back, especially after you get more projects off the ground so we can promote them.
Yeah. Go watch Mosquito and Mari. It's on Hulu, guys. Yes. You can purchase it, guys.
Yeah, you can also buy it. You can buy it. You can do that. We'll drop links on our website, cabronasychinganas.com.
Yes.
Okay, great. All right. Well, I think we're going to go ahead and close out. Once again, thank you so much. And thank you guys for listening.
Bye.